You're listening to Innovation for Alpha, where we explore everything at the intersection of healthcare innovation and finance. Through our discussions and interviews, we keep you informed and educated about healthcare innovations, next-level venture investing, and everything involving the combination of the two.
Hi, everybody. This is Tobin Arthur with Innovation for Alpha. And we are joined today by the CEO and founder of Torque3. And I think you're going to enjoy hearing the story. We've had David on the program, but it's been a number of years. And so we're excited to hear the update and talk about the company. So, David, welcome.
Oh, thank you. It's good to be talking to you again, Tuber.
We were just talking last time, I think, David and I talked. David was based and the company was in San Jose. A lot has changed since then. But, David, why don't you first part start off telling us about Torque3. What's the problem you're solving? What do you do? And then we'll get a little bit into some of the updates since we last talked.
Yeah, thanks. So Torque3 was, So we originally had a company called VreeMotion that was focused on consumer fitness. And Dr. Walter Greenleaf, one of our science advisors, walked in one day looking at our proof of concept prototype. And he's like, "You built the best neurorehabilitation platform I've ever seen." Mm-hmm. And imagine this is, you know, baling wire and duct tape. This is proof of concept. And so we didn't really do much, but Walter's incredibly good at nudge theory. So he took a year to nudge me along. People in the VR world know who Walter is. So Walter got me to finally pay attention to the research I saw his view. I could see where he was coming from on this. I just ended up meeting a friend's father had had a stroke, and he described what he had been doing for the last 2 years for recovery. And remember, now he has premium insurance, it's being paid for it. And he's had no improvement. He's still working as hard as he can. And it broke my heart, really, to listen to that story. And so I got serious about it, figured out the business case for it. Approached all the investors, and we converted the company in from VreeMotion to Torque3 in 2019. We really focused on our strategy. We really got down to the research. I brought our chief science officer aboard, Dr. Timothy Lacey, just really well known for behavioral science and understanding this, because I'll get into it, but what we're really doing is behavioral manipulation to develop neuroplasticity. And of course, then COVID hit. So we survived. And we spent that time really going through the research. I mean, it was almost, I wouldn't want to go as far as say it was beneficial for the company, but I will say that it was not lost time, not completely. We were able to take the core group, the C-suite, and just focus on how does this research that's been done over the last 50 to 70 years, and it's really that old, on neuroplasticity, and primarily done on primates. How do we actually execute that with the opportunity we've been given, with the technology we have nowadays? And if we were to say, no holds barred, just what would be our approach if we didn't have any limiting factors other than what's the technology we either have or that we think we can develop, what will we do? And we came up with a solution. And in short, the solution is what we call task-oriented therapy plus. It's a very simplistic approach. If you think about it, task-oriented therapy is fairly effective when it comes to stimulating neuroplasticity, but also very limited because depending on the individual's impairments, they can't necessarily perform them and they can't perform tasks. Well, not to mention to keep them safe, you have to end up doing very repetitive tasks. And repetition is, unfortunately, how things are really approached, and it's not what we want. We want novel. We want challenging, continually novel. That is a description of task-oriented, a good task-oriented therapy also has that. So they aren't really able, it's not the therapist's fault, they just don't have the tools to do this safely with somebody with impairment. And so what we really did is we said, okay, so let's look at this, let's think about this. And if the hypothesis that we work under is the based on the research, is that the brain is incredibly good at normalization. So if you have a brain injury, typically stroke is by far the most prominent brain injury in the world. If you have a brain injury, it takes less than a month for your brain to normalize this as being okay. And so it is no motivation to remap neural pathways to regain functionality. It doesn't know the difference, but if we were to speculate why this is, we could speculate it doesn't know the difference between, say, your arm being lost, it's just not being there if it's not getting a signal from it, to your arm being paralyzed because there's a broken connection. It's just simply not getting a response to signal.
Yep.
So it's processing a signal, it's not getting a response, it doesn't know what's happening. So therefore, it starts not pruning connections, but redirecting connections. Okay. So a very typical one, and there's people who have hypotheses why, but the very typical one is hand to eyebrow. You lose the hand, it redirects the neurons to the eyebrow. Without going into depth why people think that's happening, that's a very common one, which can, interestingly enough, if people start to regain their hand use, their eyebrow will twitch for a while as it starts to regain.
Wow.
But that normalization is your enemy. And unfortunately, repetition therapy feeds into that. It's single modality. You're essentially working from my research team calls bottom up versus top down. So they're thinking of treating the leg for a brain injury, top up, right? Well, if you repeat the motions in the leg, the brain will respond. It won't. It doesn't. And statistically speaking, we have 10% of 10% of stroke survivors recover to living an active, independent lifestyle. And you could make a certain claim, if that's 10% is universal, that they were probably younger and had milder strokes.
Okay.
We could almost say anybody with a serious stroke or who is older does not recover to live an active, independent lifestyle. I'm sure there are exceptions, I've never seen a full demographic breakdown as well as, as well as including the severity of the stroke, but we could make certain assumptions that 10% is probably the younger and or least injured. So those individuals do not recover. So we can statistically say what we're doing now doesn't really work. There may be outliers that are recovering, but for the vast majority, they are not recovering. So that's that normalization we're talking about. We have to break through that. So our approach is it's multimodal. And so what we decided to do was we said, well, first off, we have to trick the brain into something is not normal. Something needs to be fixed. And how do you do that? And here's the behavioral manipulation. We induce the perception of risk. So you want to get baby birds to fly, throw them out of the nest. They'll flap their wings before they hit the ground. I know that's an extreme example. And forgive me for all the physicians listening, for a non-physician, certainly not a neurologist, using layman terms and inaccurate analogies. But what we do is we have that inductive risk. And the best way to do that is to take a perception of risk. What we do is we convince through deep immersion, just intense deep immersion, that they are actually in a situation in the real world, but they're not.
That's the VR.
VR is one instrument. It's a deep simulation. It's a simulation. VR helps us with our simulation. But we also have, they believe they're on a quadricycle, a four-wheeled cycle, and they're controlling it. And they're pedaling through an environment which is just incredibly rich. It's rich in sounds. And we have a motion platform that gives them all of the senses of the subtle G-forces. So they believe in the motions. They believe in their orientation. So all those accelerations, not just accelerations stopping and slowing, but even lateral accelerations, they're subtle. So all of that gives them a belief. So what we have there is that deep simulation, so we can introduce risk. And we do. We've had some interesting situations. We're not trying to frighten them, but we want them to be on edge a bit. In other words, what they're doing is important. If they see, Now they're pretty much going down trails. If they see a sign that says that this area has rock slides, you should watch how tentatively they approach these things, because there may not be a rock slide. But if there is one, those boulders coming down, they don't want to be hit by them. And so on. And crossing bridges that maybe have old dilapidated bridges sometimes are challenging. We have one where they had some in an Appalachian environment where it was just, remember, these are all beautiful environments that look as if you're actually there. Mm-hmm. And they're crossing some a dilapidated rail bridge, and which is even more challenging because they have the railroad ties are constantly clicking and struggling against. Occasional animals to give them a little bit of spark. You can see a bear in a distance and hear it growl, or they see an elk run by, things that give the environment life. So it's all very deeply immersive. And the perceived risk is actually a lot of times just on the downhills, not crashing, struggling, not even going up a hill, struggling not to run over a rock in the trail, because it will make it even more slow. You'll lose momentum even more just by hitting that rock, right? So there's that perception of risk. Everything is important. Everything is urgent, right? I can't it's not just sitting there doing something mundane, repetitive. And what's more, these are all their choices. Now, to make that happen was very difficult. Because remember, they're paralyzed. Right. I mean, almost everybody has hemiplegia. I mean, to some level, they have some level of hemiplegia, some level of spasticity, cognitive issues like left side neglect or right side, but typically left side neglect. And we've seen everything. I mean, at this point, we've had everything in here. So have all these cognitive issues. Perseveration is a big one, not being able to stop pedaling, for example. So they get in here. So how do we accommodate that? Well, for the body one, what happens is we have this really dynamic asymmetrical compensation. So it takes and says, okay, what are you trying to do? I'm going to measure your unimpaired side, and I'm going to discover intent.
Okay.
And then I'm going to look at the deficit and I'm going to balance it out. And it does it 120 times a second. It's sampling. We'll increase that rate over time. It's 120. It feels smooth, but I know we can improve it. But it's weird, right? So you see somebody who comes in on a crutch and can barely move their leg, and they get on there and they just pedal smoothly.
So talk a little bit about some of the results that you've seen so far with patients. What's the range look like?
Well, first we should start that our first functional evaluation was only for participants. So let's clear this up about like what a level of, so what we've, the best words I can use is what was shown, right? Because these could be cases, but it's not our pilot studies. We have two pilot studies coming up about the end of the year. Okay. So let's just start with a bit of condition here. But out of those four, it blew us away. So the first, because we were doing a functional and safety test, the first test was very much designed to give us the data for that. It wasn't designed for outcomes. Matter of fact, you shouldn't be doing efficacy tests during a functional. But of course, the machine measures it, and we wanted to actually see what happened. So we did test them through cognitive. We had independent PTs test them before and after. We did in-house cognitive testing. We did surveys, and of course, we had machine data. I mean, the low-hanging fruit would have been the psychological. They went from all having some sort of, I wouldn't call it substantial. I would call it, because it wasn't, but I would say, out of 10, there were 4 levels of depression, anxiety, insomnia, things like that. That disappeared within 2 weeks. And that's not just the participant, that was also the spouse. Caregiver.
Interesting.
It's really interesting. They both reported the same level of psychological issues going in, and we watched them both disappear. So that was the low hanging fruit. I mean, that makes sense. But then when we also saw just incredible stuff on cognitive. It's unethical for me to talk about very specifics because it was it's a low cohort, right? It's not, we shouldn't be discussing it. But it was substantial. We had, by the end, we had one individual. I can give you anecdotal. How about we'll give you anecdotal stuff. So we had one individual had severe aphasia. He came in, he could say yes, no, and hey. Those were the three things he could say. You could give him a list of words and he could pick one. He could repeat it back to you, but he couldn't actually construct more than a single word. Okay. So by the end of this, and he was able to construct short, full sentences.
Wow.
8 weeks.
Wow.
I mean, imagine, another anecdotal thing, the same individual who, and I think you saw that in the interview, the same individual at the beginning of it, he just didn't speak to anybody. And at the end, he actually was engaging. And this changed his home life. His wife said, I think it was week six or seven, she said she came home from work and he was making dinner for the family. Mm. And I mean, we're talking about that independence, active, you know, active and independent. Active and independent doesn't mean that you're somehow you're going to go out and play tennis.
Right.
It means that you're mobile enough to go out your life and that you're independent from other caretakers. This is really, really important for everybody involved. So he's starting to achieve that even on the first 8 weeks. Now he's back for another 8 week. We're doing for a different kind of test. But the,
anecdotally, yeah. You know, clearly there's some promise here. No doubt.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the business and kind of where the milestones that you're looking to achieve over the next 6-12 months. Talk a little bit about that. And then we'll talk about what you're looking for in terms of, you know, if somebody's got interest in this, what are the types of people that might be able to get involved?
We want our company mission is not to have one of those premier pieces in a few institutions. And and we all know how that works. I charge, you know, $250 million for the basics model. And then you buy a bunch of accessories on top of that. And then you have to pay $50,000 to $100,000 a year for your service contract.
Right.
And the only people who can get that is people who can either somebody's donating it to them or they have a very high budget. So you end up going to Mayo Clinic, Stanford, et cetera. And a very handful of these places exist. That doesn't fit within our mission. Our mission is to make this ubiquitous and available to everybody who needs it. So once we, you know, if we have efficacy, the next challenge of the company is to make that happen. So a very difficult business model to accomplish that. And because it relies on volume to work. So how we plan to do that, at least now, is we will actually open a few flagship centers.
Okay.
Now, we have a couple of different ways to, so that's essentially proving it to the market and building the brand. Okay. Now, beyond that, we now have to get it out to everybody who wants to use it in their business and make it an economically viable tool for them to use. So there's many ways for us to, many things on our plate. And matter of fact, by the end of the month, we'll have that go-to-market plan. So I don't really want to commit to a go-to-market plan now.
Fair enough.
That may be different in 2 weeks.
Okay.
Because we do have a big meeting next week with the board of directors, with everybody putting in proposals. So whatever it is, it's going to be something like a platform as a service where you pay a rate to get the platform. We continue to own it. You pay a reasonable rate that still allows for the clinics to make profit.
Yep.
There could be a franchise model. There could be some. So there's a direct model to where we don't make it an expensive piece of equipment to acquire.
Yeah.
But we instead rely on the fact that we will have a large volume of these out there and support system for them. So therefore, we make money on volume versus low numbers of very expensive pieces of equipment. Because as you could imagine, it's not an inexpensive piece of equipment. Right. So the but it is. But you know, most clinics will be able to use it not just for neural rehabilitation, although that's our core niche. It's better for ortho as well. I mean, it's just a better. Would you rather go ride the stationary bike, or would you rather go drop into a redwood forest, or the Appalachians, or a bamboo forest, or you know, and go for trail rides, and where the machine is monitoring you and adjusting to make sure it attends to your injury? We actually have one of our participants just has hip replaced. The best part of his day. He loves it because it sort of distracts him from the pain.
Sure.
I think he's past when he started the program, he was 3 weeks from the time he had his hip replaced and he had no problems at all. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say he didn't feel pain. He was just distracted from it. Mm-hmm. But yeah,
no, that's pretty neat. When you, let me ask, are there reimbursement codes that would be relevant here? Or are you thinking it's cash pay or both?
Well, I mean, cash pay works for everything, but the CPT codes for these are identical because the way for rehabilitation, the CPT codes are attached to the therapist, not the equipment.
Okay.
So it doesn't matter what. So, we're, FDA registered. So we could commercialize it as of today. And you could charge, you could charge CPT codes for it because you're really just billing for the therapist. We would be able to establish it as a standard of care, therefore it getting its own code.
Yeah.
So equipment or equipment like it would get its own code. But that's got to be 2-3 years down the road before we can even address that because it'll be, clinical trial level reinforcement. And obviously metadata over us using it on a large group of people will be really important for that.
Let's wrap with a kind of a call to action, if you will, because I think we've got a good sense that there's something really interesting going on clinically here. You'll know more about outcomes as you go through some of these upcoming studies. And you guys have poured a lot into the engineering on this. You're working on the business model. It'd be great to hear a little bit about that go-to-market in the coming weeks, provide us an update and we'll share that as an update. So talk a little bit about, if somebody's listening to this, who are the types of people right now that you're talking to and need to interact with? Is it investors? Is it potential users? Is it all the above?
Well, it's all the above, but a couple of key things that are happening right now is we would really like to bring somebody on the team who's been either was a CEO of a rehabilitation hospital or is currently CEO of a rehabilitation hospital, likely, possibly as an advisor, but quite possibly also as a director on the board. Mm. So we're really looking for that going as part of our go-to-market and growth strategy. That's if somebody has recommendations, would love to hear from that. Okay. And obviously fundraising, somebody can reach out. If they want to be, join our team as an investor, we will probably be in fundraising mode for at least the next 4 months, different levels as we go out with our seed rounds, et cetera. So, and I find that, actually find physicians get what we're doing more than other. They experience it. They know the problem. Whereas I do believe it's a bit of a hidden problem for most people. Unless you're a physician, you don't notice all the people and they tend to actually stay at home. So you don't understand that there's about 1 million people each year in the United States that have some sort of neuro injury, mostly again, stroke, 800,000 stroke survivors. And then there are stroke people. And it's 10 times that is what we have as existing stroke survivors. Mm. So you're looking at 10 million people in the United States that are living impaired, from mostly stroke, but some sort of neuro injury. And there's no solution that's really addressing the problem. So we're trying to be that solution.
Well, it's super novel. David, what we'll do is in the show notes and in other places, we're going to list some links. I'll talk to you and get some things from you in terms of some specifics that maybe we can post. But in there, I'm going to encourage people to go to your website. You've got some pretty neat information there. People can get a pretty good sense of what the system does. And we'd love to keep some updates. So appreciate, David, the update. Really novel, really interesting, and a great space. Like you said, there's really not a whole lot out there. And if only 10% of people are legitimately rehabbing, that means there's a lot of work to do.
Well, look, they say 80% of the people that leave inpatient the first 2 weeks, right? Right after acute care, you get 2 weeks of inpatient neural rehabilitation. Mm-hmm. 80% do not finish, and their provider covered neural rehabilitation, outpatient rehabilitation. Mm. Most of those never even go in because they're being told at inpatient not to expect results.
Oh, wow.
Which they're not lying. It's just sort of sad. It's just sort of sad that they're not even going and trying because there's no good solution. So the market space is obviously ready for disruption, and we're poising ourselves to do that.
Well, I appreciate your time, David, and we'll definitely be keeping an eye on Torque 3. Sounds like you've got a busy and important year coming up, so thank you.
Yeah. Thank you again, Tubin. Bye.
See you again soon for the next episode of Innovation for Alpha. Make sure to go to Innovation for Alpha for access to prior episode links, show notes, and other valuable resources. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any investment decisions, please consult with a professional. This show is copyrighted by Angel Indie Media, and written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.